Hello and welcome to this week's program. I'm Paul Nelson. If the world is to survive well into the third millennium, a transition to a feminine, whole systems approach is paramount. Fortunately, many of the people who make it their business to promulgate a partnership approach see the tide turning toward not just a tolerance for diversity, but an honoring of it and a rejection of the prevailing competition domination model. One of the world's brightest whole systems thinkers is internationally renowned scholar and author Gene Houston. Gene is back with a manual of hope for this critical time in human history. The book is Jump Time, Shaping Your Future in a World of Radical Change. She says one encouraging trend is America's fastest growing segment of consumers, a group known as cultural creatives.
Cultural creatives are like you and me. We're people who volunteer, who have hope, who are interested in human, our own interior development, but as a way to unfold being of real use in the world. Women are very important, and women's styles of knowing, holistic, circular, looking for process rather than product.
Gene says that Aristotle's concept of entelechy, or the force which drives an organism toward self-fulfillment, is the best reason to be optimistic for the planet's future, as this is the best course for what we all crave, personal freedom.
Spirituality gives us access to a much larger bandwidth of being. You know, we are living in the kingdom then. We're not living on the outskirts or in the suburbs, you know. We are, as Yeshua ben Yosef, you know, Jesus of Nazareth said, you know, that the kingdom is both within you and, it, another translation, is in the midst of you. But it really needs the deep work of consciousness.
One of our favorite guests is an amazing myriad-minded woman who has a very deep understanding of the way things need to be as well as the best ways to get there. I hope you enjoy today's program with Gene Houston, author of Jump Time, Shaping Your Future in a World of Radical Change. It's Jump Time, the end of the second millennium, Armageddon, the second coming, the rapture, the decline of Western civilization, the post-American century, the Pacific century, the age of Aquarius, the time after the death of the old gods, before the birth of the new. The time after the death of the old gods, before the birth of the new. As we await the birthing of the new gods and goddesses, what better inspiration for this time of whole system transition than a new book from Gene Houston? A best-selling author, internationally renowned scholar, philosopher, and teacher, Gene is the co-director of the Foundation for Mind Research in Ashland, Oregon. A consultant to UNICEF and other international agencies, she's a self-described heretic psychologist and one of the all-time favorite guests of this program. Today, we welcome the perfect midwife for Jump Time, Gene Houston. Just a delight to have you on the show. You know, in fact, whenever people say, well, what kind of show do you do? What kind of guests do you have? Invariably, yours is the first name in a stream that rolls off my tongue. Gene Houston, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, Barbara Marx Hubbard, Mary Catherine Bateson, Rian Eisler, blah, 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 blah. And so just a delight to have you on the show. You get this stuff as well as or perhaps better than anyone on the planet, even my poetry heroes and sheroes like Michael McClure and Diane DePrima, really. And thanks for coming down here and enlightening us.
Well, I don't know about enlightening, but I think we can have a very good time.
Oh, well,
we always do, Paul.
That's
together.
Good. That's good.
Especially that you're in love now. Makes it even better.
It makes it easier, doesn't it? Not so much of a struggle. And we're going to talk about that. Not necessarily my love life, thank God, but how love affects one's quest for individuation. The new book is entitled Jump Time, Shaping Our Future in a World of Radical Change. I feasted on the book even more than your previous offerings. Now, if there's a criticism I have, which is a strange way to open up the interview, it's that the book seems to be very accessible. Now, maybe I've been reading too much language poetry, but is that an accurate take? Is it an accessible book, and was that intentional?
Accessible.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, because I've written too many inaccessible books. And to write an accessible book takes a lot more time, a lot more honing, a lot of deepening, so that you don't just sort of go off in a great pyrotechnics of metaphor and speaking to other domains of yourself. but you find yourself really in communion and communication. Also, I did this book as a year-long course that I taught to my mystery school, and so I think it has that kind of sense of direct communication, person to person.
Well, you know, there still are pyrotechnics in it, and there still is difficulty. There's a stuff that, you know, I have to look up to get, and especially the myth, which is one of my deficiencies. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying it's for simpletons, but, well, I enjoyed the book. It's very readable. Jump time has been a key phrase of yours for a long time.
Yes.
You mentioned on the show last time you were on. How was it coined?
Well, it just jumped into my head, but I think it jumped into my head after I had read many years ago Stephen Jay Gould and Niels Eldridge's work on punctuated equilibrium, that when you study the fossil record, there really are missing links, and they don't fill up. You know, old Freud, old Darwin said, well, they're going to fill up, but of course they didn't, and toward the end of his life, even he was disturbed by it. Because it would seem that a species goes on in a certain way for thousands, even in some cases millions of years, and nothing much happens, and then suddenly jump in relatively few generations in terms of evolutionary history. It moves to a whole new regime. And so I ask, why? Is it because a species has a kind of coded time release pattern that it will make these changes? Is it at the edge of its tolerance? Is it bored with itself? Is it climactic conditions? Whatever it is, the fact is that things do enter into a jumps, whole system transition. And what I say in this book is, judging by where we are now in the new millennium, I think that we are in a jump time as formidable as may have happened to species in millions of years past.
And you talk about previous jump times, a time when the Declaration of Independence was signed, the Renaissance being a prime example, and this is a jump time to dwarf all jump times.
Yes, I mean, this is the most interesting time in human history. Other times thought they were it. They're wrong. This is it. This is it.
Well, thanks for clarifying.
That's right. I thought you'd like that.
That's a nice little soundbite. Let me write that down. A time of whole system transition. Why don't you?
Well, everything is up for grabs. I mean, the maps don't fit the territory. It's as if we're attending awake for a way of being that has been ours for hundreds, even thousands of years. And tomorrow will not look like yesterday. I think, for example, as we're recording this, we have just learned that the Human Genome Project has been virtually completed. Now, it wasn't supposed to be completed for another 5 years. What is happening, not simply in technology, I mean, where were you and I when we first began our shows, you know, 4 or 5 years ago? And where was the internet? You know, it was sort of it was just sort of vaguely there.
Pre-web.
And in the last 4 years, look what has happened. A world of colossal busybodiness, the world mind taking a walk with itself. You introduced me by saying the new gods and new goddesses. Well, one of the things that's happening is fusion. Suddenly Athena is doing lunch with White Buffalo Woman, you know, and Isis and Mary Magdalene are having a fine time. So we have this cross-fusion cultural mitosis. The food has changed radically. And all this, I go into simple, what I think of simple towns in Iowa, and I find a Middle Eastern restaurant that also has a sideline in Chinese cuisine. I was in San Francisco the other day, and there was a Jewish Chinese restaurant, Genghis Khan. You know,
you're making it up.
No, I'm not making it up. I know it's there. I swear to God, it's there. You know. I mean, you can also find the French-German hideaway, you know, Stollen Quiches, but...
I think I did read that.
No, that one, that's a joke.
But the
new world music that you play here, that music that is a, you know, hybrid sounds for hybrid selves. Now, if I were to go back 1,000 years ago, I'm Scotch and Sicilian, and if I were to go back to my Scotch relatives, my Sicilian relatives 1,000 years ago, probably fairly sophisticated, living under a kind of Arabic, interesting, decadent Arabic culture. But I go back 1,000 years ago to my Scotch relatives, and their names were probably something like Hugo, son of Stupid, and Clothilde the Cuckoo. And they had really a very dull life. I mean, they would wake up in the morning in their mud and wattle hut because the chicken would walk across their face, you know. And then they'd get up, and it was always raining in the 11th century, you know, and they got behind the plow. And maybe on Sunday they got hold of a hogshead of meat and would fall into a ditch, and that was the big event. But then, led by mad monks and greedy nobles, my ancestors, Hugo and Clothilde, got up and went east on the Crusades. And they come to Byzantium, glorious, decadent Byzantium, with everyone sounding like an ancient Byzantine version of Noel Coward, don't you know? Oh, darling, you're into Proclus. How too Neoplatonic, you know, and savoring saffron-laden dishes with pistachios. And then they go on to Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, you know, the great place of the crossroads of spirit bursting through, the place everybody wants and everybody wants to be in, you know, spirit becoming incarnate in flesh. And then they go back to Scotland. Well, how are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Byzantium and Jerusalem? You can't. And so they begin to, old Hugo starts to create spice trading, and their child begins to build medieval cathedrals, and the soul of man vaults the sky in universities. Now, that was then. That's 1,000 years ago. Now, multiplied millions of times, and you can just see what is happening to consciousness. It is not the same mind. It is not the same body.
It's the same story, trade with the Iroquois Confederacy, and perhaps that's the hope of what will come out of NAFTA and GATT and these kinds of agreements, that kind of change, that kind of evolution, that kind of appreciation for other cultures. We're talking with Jean Houston. She's the author of Jump Time, Shaping Your Future in a World of Radical Change. I'm Paul Nelson. You know, I've heard from secondhand reports that NASA research to help astronauts have an easier time at reacclimating to Earth living, they set the frequency of the spaceships at the same frequency of Earth. And after 20 years of travel, space travel, they say, wait, the frequency of Earth actually has changed. Is it not vibrating at a higher frequency these days?
I don't know that for a fact, Paul, but I certainly, like you, I have anecdotal evidence. But if a planet is a living system, Gaia, if she's living, then why wouldn't she change her vibration? I mean, she is a great lady after all, and so she she's subject to all kinds of changes. I don't think she's in a menopausal shift.
Let's hope not. Goes 100 years for that.
Shrug your shoulders and we all fall off. sure, I mean, one of the things, as you know, I've done some work as an astronaut, and one of the things they said was, you know, you come back floating back to Earth, and there she is, that beautiful blue and silver planet floating in the womb of the cosmos. And as Ed Mitchell said to me, I felt such nostalgia for what the world could be. And you knew her to be alive, and you knew that you had left as her baby and came back as her co-partner. And that's also a major piece of this shift. I really suspect that if there is, just like in the movie 2001, when they touch that great rectangle, zoop, you know, and everything shifts in them. I suspect that it was that picture of the seeing of the Earth from outer space that activated some, if you will, some radical evolutionary latency in us, and that's why it began to shift. I was in China, central China, 1983, and I was present when a peasant in his little house pulled down the picture of Mao Zedong, and who did he replace it with? The picture of the whole Earth from outer space.
I thought you were going to say Elvis there for a second.
No, not Elvis. I was present in when I was staying with some lepers in southern India. And there next to Saraswati and Ganesha and Parvati and Shiva, the picture of the Earth from outer space. It's an evolutionary event. And with it, we move into a level of partnership that for which we've been ill-prepared. And what part of my book is about how do we prepare ourselves for this level of partnership, this complexity that is upon us, because most of us have still been educated to be white males of the year 1926.
Well, let's talk about that. The shadow looms larger than ever. The peace dividend, remember that? We were talking about that a few years ago. Now that's a distant soundbite. And fundamentalism of all kinds is rampant on the planet. You see this as a case of a rat fighting hardest when cornered?
First of all, fundamentalism is not rampant throughout the planet. Fundamentalism is extolled for its excitement of the media. Some of the worst fundamentalisms that I have seen, you know, apart from certain tribal fundamentalisms in Africa, Arabic fundamentalisms, Islamic fundamentalisms, has been in the United States, quite frankly. In many countries, you see nothing like this. But I think what it is, of course, is the sunset effect. That the sun always blares out, "Wee, here I am before I go down." And also part of one of the major aspects of any living system is not rocking the boat, a kind of natural entropy, so that things have to prove themselves before they really can go forward.
Homeostasis.
Homeostasis, absolutely.
Yeah. And you say there's a regenesis of society happening, a change from the egocentric to the world-centric. We were just talking
about
that.
I think it'll take a century to do it. But certainly globalization is with us, whether we will or not. But a lot of, as you may know, I do a lot of work in many cultures around the world. And one of the things that I see happening is cultures coming back. The Balinese have become more Balinese. Maybe it's because Americans and Japanese and Europeans have acted the way the de Medicis did in the Renaissance, you know, that they honored the poets and the players and the artists and the dancers. And so the Balinese say, oh, well, you appreciate our society. That's wonderful. We'll deepen it, you know. And they have. And at the same time, they've created this incredibly wealthy textile industry, you know, using their batiks in terms of new and innovative forms. I've worked with Maori people and Aborigines in Australia to appreciate their culture and to appreciate and not just to appreciate but to have them deepen their culture while they move into the next century. So I've been in situations in Arnhem Land in Australia where you have people doing 50,000-year-old puberty rites and dancing with the white chalk on their face. And in the background, there's also a dish antenna.
Yeah, interesting. Cultural creatives is something you mentioned in the book. They listen to the show. They buy your books. They provide hope in terms of an emerging movement. Paul Ray is the person who coined the term through his research of 20 years. We were talking about
10 years of serious work, and then it began many years ago for him.
A good sign, cultural creatives? Can you describe what they are?
Well, cultural creatives are like you and me. We're people who volunteer, who have hope, who are interested in human, our own interior development, but as a way to unfold being of real use in the world. Women are very important, and women's styles of knowing, holistic, circular, looking for process rather than product. There are actually two kinds of cultural creatives. There is the one I've just described, and there's ones called the Greens. And the Greens may not be that interested in inner space, but by golly, they're interested in, you know, saving the world. And between the two, it's about 46 million people, which is a very substantial part. Old Toynbee used to say, for any society to change, you needed a 10% creative minority. And with the cultural creatives, you have almost 15%, almost 20%.
What's taken so long?
It hasn't taken long at all as cultures go.
You don't think so?
Oh, no. You know, I'm a collector of antiquities. I've dug in Egypt and Greece, and it's very important to me. And I can look at a piece of sculpture that I might own. It's 4,000 years old, from the end of the Old Kingdom, beginning of the Middle Kingdom, and then I can look at something from the Ptolemaic period, of, you know, say the 2nd century BC, 1st century BC. And there's not that, you know, you can see differences, of course, but still the basic structure is there. But now, I mean, that's you're talking 4,000 years. Can you imagine what would happen 4,000 years between now and then? No. So that's also jump time, that kind of acceleration. Things are not being carried over. They are reconstituting themselves. We're in a time of radical deconstruction and reconstruction of every way of known way of being, having, thinking. I mean, if you went back to your ancestors, even of 150 years ago, think of what their experiences were, and then contrast them with what your experience is, and the fact that you probably live anywhere between 5 to 10 to 100 times the amount of sheer experience of your ancestor of 100 years ago. Now, this affects the nervous system. It affects your poetry. It affects your musical ear. It affects everything. Things are not structured in the same way because chaos is always looming within to both illumine and then to, destroy and then to reconfigure, living in a time of absolute deconstruction and reconstruction all the time. No, it's not the same mind.
Wow. A core concept of the book is the Aristotelian concept of entelechy.
Yes.
Dictionary.com says, number two, a vital force that directs an organism toward self-fulfillment.
Yes.
That perhaps the key component of jump time, is it not?
Yeah, I think, I use it in a more psychological and spiritual sense. And I use it the way Aristotle used it when he said it is the entelechy of an acorn to be an oak tree. It's the entelechy, of course, of a baby to be, you know, a grown-up human being entelechy, if I were to be whimsical about it, of a popcorn kernel to be a fully popped entity. But that we have within us a kind of directive, creative purpose, a pattern of unfolding, that if we get in touch with it, suddenly it is the yellow brick road, you know, the road of spiritual pollen. It is the unfolding of qualities and capacities and emotions and feelings and options and opportunities that would not normally be there when we are living out of a much narrow bandwidth, a bandwidth of serial monotony or just doing what we're expected to be doing.
How did your own entelechy coalesce?
How does it, my own entelechy?
How did it coalesce? How did it come together for you?
You know, it's interesting. I've never been asked that. I think it was always there. Part of my family was a very spiritually minded family. My mother was a Sicilian Catholic, but not terribly happy with the rigor and restrictions. And so she was having leanings towards New Thought, you know. So that was always there in my early childhood. I was theologically precocious. I was not precocious in math or other things, but I was very, you know, I was always interested in where is spirit. And I had an experience, I don't know if I ever talked about it on this show, where I was sent to Catholic school when I was 5 years old, just for some months. And my father, the comedy writer, gave me interesting questions to ask the poor little nun every morning. Sister Teresa, when Jesus rose, was that because God filled him full of helium? You know. Sister Teresa, when Ezekiel saw the wheel, was he drunk? And then the one that really got her. Sister Teresa, I counted my ribs and I counted Joy Mangiabella's ribs, and we got the same number of ribs. And I want to know, if God made Eve out of Adam's rib, how come, and I had 36 little Catholic children, Sicilian Catholic children, raise their shirts, you know, at the same time. But the really bad one was, Sister Teresa, did Jesus ever have to go to the bathroom? Woo, that did it. She jumped up. She pinned up a big sheet of oak tag, and she wrote on it, Jean Houston's ears in purgatory. Well, anytime I asked one of these questions, she lisped very badly, too. She would shout, blasphemy, blasphemy.
Oh, that's where it's...
Sacrilege and blasphemy. And she'd put up a big X, and each X represented 100,000 years. And the end of, you know, at the end of the first grade, when I turned six, I had 300 million years in purgatory to my credit, and I had no future in the Catholic Church. And I went home crying, and my father, to try to make me feel better, he said, wait till you see how they hogtied a real saint. And he took me to see the Song of Bernadette, and with a beautiful motion picture about a religious experience starring Jennifer Jones as Bernadette. And everything was fine, except when the Virgin Mary makes this extraordinary epiphany, this beautiful, luminous epiphany in the grotto. And my father, who was a great one for laughter, couldn't stop laughing. He howled, he hooted, and all the Sicilians turned around and said, hey, diabolo, diabolo. And my father, I said, Daddy, get out of here, go to the bathroom. He says, you know who that is up there on the screen? We met her last year in that party at Beverly Hills, and she's playing Mary now. Hot damn, I told her she'd go far. It was this starlet whom he had known called Linda Darnell. And he couldn't get over this rather unlikely person playing the Virgin Mary. Well, we went home, and I went and I threw myself into the closet and I began to pray to the Virgin Mary to show up. And I kept counting the great numbers and closing my eyes and hoping she would come and I would give up candy. And nobody showed up. And finally, I just gave up and I went and I sat by the bay window, and I looked out at the fig tree blooming in the yard and the plane in the sky, and then it happened. Suddenly, everything was available, everything, and I knew that I and that fig tree in the yard and the doggies in the closet that I had been trying to pull out of the closet so the Virgin Mary wouldn't step on them, and, you know, the plane in the sky, I knew it was all part of this great symphonic weave. Everything was interrelated to everything else. Everything was part of a kind of a colossal, divine, symphonic, poetic pattern. And it was very, very good. And I knew it was my job to evoke that sensibility in others. So that's how my entelechy coalesced.
Well, boy, you're doing a fine job. We're talking with Jean Houston. Her new book is Jump Time, Shaping Your Future in a World of Radical Change.